Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute past the hour. Good evening. Welcome. It is Titanic Tuesday on the Horn. This is the Horn, the Head On Radio Network, headonradionetwork.com. Easily accessed via the interweb tubes, most easily, simply by going to headonradionetwork.com, clicking Listen Live, and accessing the easy-to-access player there. There are, however, a number of other ways of going about it, including including apps that will work on your mobile device, so you can take the Horn with you whithersoever thou wishest to go. My, aren't we Elizabethan tonight? What kind of apps, you ask? Well, let me just suggest TuneIn Radio. And, of course, they're also online. Stitcher Internet Radio. Tuner Internet Radio app, Dar.fm, Streama.com, Roku devices. We're all over the place. And if there are others, do by all means let me know, because we want to make sure that they get proper credit for carrying the Horn. For we do indeed appreciate it. The podcast address is right there, easy to find, at WhiteRoseSociety.org under the Head On with Bob Kincaid subdomain. And you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Okay. Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. The Horn is an effort that is driven entirely by your determination to continue having progressive, independent, no-holds-barred conversation. This little experiment that we began More than eight, really. 2013 will mark 10 years in radio for me, or 10 years back in radio. I've been back and forth on a number of occasions, but came back to radio in 2003. We started this little exercise in 2005. October 24th, as a matter of fact. And it is your contributions that keep this all going. If you go to headonradionetwork.com, you will look at, you'll see our little bar graph there that indicates how far we have to go in fundraising. We have not changed the bar graph yet. John Fox has been incredibly busy. He stays incredibly busy, and yet still finds time to help keep all of this going. By virtue of a suggestion made by our buddy Tom a couple of weeks ago, monthly fundraising goal, at his suggestion, has been raised to $3,000. So what you will find is that between now and the 15th, we're at about $455 away from the halfway mark of the month. It's doable, I think. We had big help. We had big help today from a new listener. Really inspiring and exciting. Got a note from Gregory. He said, I stumbled onto your show about a month ago when I was listening to various programs on the White Rose Society website. Needless to say, I've been hooked ever since. I usually listen to your previous day's show at work, but I plan on listening live in the near future. I especially enjoy Moran Monday and prayer meeting Wednesday. I said all of that to say, please accept my contribution of $120. I will continue to listen to your program and support the Horn financially, as well as continuing to wage my own war against morans, fundies, repiglickens, and bigots, parenthetically, which are sometimes mutually exclusive, but not usually. Here in Texas, Stan, keep up the great work. Thank you so very much, Gregory. This is the only way it continues. So we're slowly catching up with where we need to be, and we can get to where we ought to be, I think. You know, if you look at it as from the $2,500 model, the monthly model, it's even closer if you go and look at the bar graph. Because that would be 1,250 would be the halfway point, which means that we're about $205 away between now and the 50. But if we are to build that cushion that Tom was talking about, it's more like 455. Yeah, that's right. Math on the fly, not my strong suit. But at any rate, this is Titanic Tuesday. Titanic Tuesday being named, of course, in honor of a story our buddy Jim once told not too awfully long back about the right-wing genius who explained to his faithful yet not too bright listeners that there are fossilized shellfish in the strata, the rock strata of West Virginia, that are a result of the shifting of the Titanic plates. Big plates. Titanic plates. Yes. And that's, you know, that's the quality of intellect that you get with right-wingery. Here's a question. And we got all kinds of stories tonight, but this is just a place to start. By the way, have you ever been to the headonradionetwork.com chat room? A lot of interaction goes on there. You can email the program as well, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid at gmail.com. You can also reach the program via Skype. But my handle, Bob Kincaid, BobKincaid, Horn, Horn, all one word, all lowercase, Bob Kincaid Horn. That's how you get through on Skype. But at any rate, if you've never been to the headonradionetwork.com chat room, it's easy to enter. It's free, and it's fun to interact back and forth there as well. And so I'm putting out a little, okay, so consider this sort of a survey, well, it's not really going to be a survey question because we're going to move into the meat of the story. But if I were to read to you a headline, I think Beth turned me on to this one last night. If I were to read to you a headline and tell you that the dateline was Phoenix, although I guess maybe the dateline doesn't. What if the dateline was New York? What if the dateline was Massachusetts? Or Florida? Or California? Or Washington? Or Oregon? Or Alabama? Never mind the dateline. I probably shouldn't have brought that up. But if I was to simply read you a headline that said, "Woman runs down husband with car for not voting." Do you think that you could speculate with any reasonable degree of certainty about, for instance, the politics of the woman who ran down her husband with an automobile for not voting? And I don't ask this as a function of some sort of smartassery. This is a serious question. Because it goes to the mindsets of the two entirely separate and distinct sides of the great national debate taking place in our country at the present time. This far from more perfect union of ours. With some reasonable degree of certainty, could you speculate as to the politics of the woman who ran down her husband with an automobile? Here's the background. Well, the most serious background is that 36-year-old Daniel Solomon is presently in critical condition at the hospital. How did it happen? It started in a parking lot. This was on the Saturday following last week's election. you know, a week ago tonight, as we were all sitting huddled, tense, clenched up, generally all of us looking like a dog trying to pass a peach pit, wondering if Barack Obama would be reelected, and if he did, what that would mean. See, this is the fun with the chat room, Mr. Gibson in the chat room. Bob, people with enlarged amygdalas do this kind of thing. That's the big lizard brain. That's a clue. There is some scientific peer-reviewed research out there to suggest that certain types of people have enlarged lizard brains, the amygdala. It was a Saturday morning. The couple, Mr. and Mrs. Solomon, Daniel and Holly, in a parking lot, when Mrs. Solomon became enraged at her spouse. See, that's how it works, Sparky, in the chat room. Well, you get three guesses, and the first two don't count. Mrs. Solomon, aged 28, became furious, enraged, beside herself, because her husband didn't vote last Tuesday. She then got in her car. And really, the sequence of events kind of goes to intent. It goes to state of mind. There were lots of places where she could have not run over her husband in this entire chain of events. Screamy, screamy, back and forth. Honey, honey, just calm down. Please, honey. And I'm not honeying as some form of sexism. I mean, no. But she didn't, so she unlocks the car. Beep, beep. She flings the door open. She gets in the car. Husband's still standing there, kind of flabbergasted. She then puts her foot on the brake, puts her seatbelt on, closes the door, puts the key in the ignition, turns the ignition, starts the car, puts the car in gear, and begins to chase her husband around the parking lot like something out of a twisted version of a Alfred Hitchcock movie. Like Cary Grant running through the cornfield North by Northwest, only he's being chased by an automobile and not a biplane. It wasn't much of a chase. Races between cars and people on foot seldom are. She caught up with her husband, and she ran him over. And the man is presently in critical condition in hospital. Now that's the whole setup. Quick, tell me the politics of Mrs. Solomon. I kind of let the cat out of the bag, you know, Arizona. You know her politics, don't you? Police say that she became furious at him because of, quote, lack of voter participation, and that she believed there is that single most dangerous word in the English language. She believed that her family would, in journalistic speak from Reuters news agency, she believed her family would face hardship as a result of Obama winning another term. I don't have to tell you skin color, do I? I didn't think so. this is getting more bizarre by the second. It is a story out of Arizona, and the reason I mentioned the story of Mr. and Mrs. Solomon out of Arizona is because we've got a rare treat coming this evening. If you wish to understand the bizarre political dynamics, and in fact the dangerous anti-immigrant, proto-fascist trends that are at work in this country, you really do have to come to terms or understand Arizona. Now, we've been all awash in stories out of Florida and Ohio, but there were all kinds of voter shenanigans in Arizona. In fact, a new book, State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, is fairly hot off the presses from a very dear friend of this show, Jeff Biggers. Jeff will be joining us in the third hour of the program this evening. He documents it all in State Out of the Union. The fact, for instance, that a number of states, a frightening number of states, have introduced their own anti-immigrant legislation in the last couple of years based almost exclusively on Arizona's SB 1070 Papers, Please law. And Jeff has the inside skinny on the voter suppression that was taking place and arguably still takes place in Arizona. Now, as I said, Jeff is a great friend of the Horn. I first met Jeff when he had authored and published what I consider to be the essential textbook of this little attempt at redefining what talk-based radio can be. Jeff is the American Book Award-winning author of The United States of Appalachia. If you care about this region, you should own that book, too. Jeff is a brilliant journalist, world traveler, and has a profound ability to translate into narrative the hopes and dreams and ambitions, the struggles, the oppression, and the very lives themselves of oppressed peoples, from Appalachia to Arizona to the Rarámuri people of the Sierra Madre of Mexico. So Jeff will be joining us in the third hour of the program for a conversation about Arizona. We'll probably also touch on Appalachia, the coal culture. We'll talk some about immigrant rights. I think you will find what he has to say engaging and inspiring. Because once you get an idea of how profound are the stakes in this contest, you might even be moved to take an active part in the struggle for freedom that is always the province of a society that hopes to someday call itself free. So, coming up in the third hour, a little bit after 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Jeff Biggers. in conversation right here this evening. Now, Jim noting of the Mr. and Mrs. Solomon, yeah, I'd think they had other marital problems, don't you? We don't know. She ran him down and left him pinned under the car until the rescue workers could arrive. The Solomons are from Mesa, Arizona, and he was transported to a hospital in Scottsdale where he remains in critical condition. Yeah, this isn't a story that you can offer up as any kind of a kicker or funny story at the end of the program. Because, you see, these teabaggers, these right-wingers, these Republicans are literally deadly in earnest. And they will have no way, they will have their way or no way. Oh, God, sometimes I wish this was a television show. I'd love to show you this photograph. Because it fits so perfectly. It just came in. You know, we had the story last night about the 15 or 20 states or so that have written petitions to the White House asking to be relieved of their particular state's membership in the Union. The word for that is secede. David in South Carolina just sent me a photograph of some teabaggers out there getting ready to carry their message. And their message is spelled out letter by letter on great big cards, one letter per card. And their message is SECD. Really. SECDEE exclamation point. SECD. I think you got your... I think you got one E out of place there, Beauregard. God, teabaggers. Oh. Yeah, we can have our giggles. But these guys are in earnest. One of those petitions that we mentioned last night comes from Georgistan. Jeff Biggers is presently on his way to Georgia. What an interesting story he will have to tell about that. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporting, in a story that Agnes sent along. Oh, the number's growing. Residents of more than 30 states have now signed petitions asking to secede from the Union. With tongue firmly planted in cheek, Katie Leslie of the Journal-Constitution writes, Georgia, with one notable secession under its belt, is among them. By Tuesday evening, the Georgia petition online at whitehouse.gov was approaching the 25,000 signatures needed to prompt an official White House response. The petition asks that the one-time 13th colony be allowed to create its own new government. Danny Dukes is one of the signatories of the Georgia petition. He says, it's like the Boston Tea Party sending a message saying, we're fed up with the way things are. We want progress and direction and leadership and don't agree with the route things are taking. Racial issues have been checked at the doorstep for a long time. In my mind, it's not an issue. Now, that doesn't jibe with Tyrone Brooks, president of the Georgia Association of Black Elected Officials. He says, it's nothing but race. Some people are upset at the fact that we have an African-American president. People forget about the fact that half of him is white. there they are, talking secession. How bad is it? Well, this is how bad. Texas governor and ranch owner, and we all remember the name of his ranch, right? Rick Perry, because of all the secession talk, was forced to respond. Because Perry, at some teabagging rally out in front of the Alamo a year or so ago, said that, you know, secession might be the very thing for us. Now, while the 25,000 signature threshold has almost been reached in Georgia, Texas blew past that a long time ago in theirs. They're up to around, as of the timing of this article, 62,000 people. According to an account at Raw Story. So that means the administration will have to craft some sort of a response. My suggestion to the administration is that the response that they craft, well, there's really no response to craft. You just go back and you quote Andrew Jackson, like I mentioned last night. His response to South Carolina when they wanted to get all froggy and secede. Or, as teabaggers put it, set D. But with 62,000 signatories to the signers to the petition, Governor Rick Perry had to weigh in. And Governor Perry's office issued a statement to the Dallas Morning News as follows. Governor Perry believes in the greatness of our union and nothing should be done to change it. But he also shares the frustrations many Americans have with our federal government. Now more than ever, our country needs strong leadership from states like Texas that are making tough decisions to live within their means. No, they're not. Texas is not living within its means. Texas would be a state probably poorer than Bangladesh if it were not for the billions of dollars that have flowed into Texas coffers as a result of money coming back to it from you and me and the taxes we pay to the federal government. Texans pay out federal taxes, but Texas gets back a lot more than it pays out. So, no, they're not living within their means. For Texas to live with, for Texas to live within its means would be if the state budget of Texas contained nothing but taxes paid by Texans. You know, state taxes. Anyway, now more than ever, our country needs strong leadership from states like Texas that are making tough decisions to live within their means, keep taxes low. See, that's going to be a problem once you secede. And provide opportunities to job creators so their citizens can provide for their families and prosper. We cannot allow Washington's tax and spend one-size-fits-all mindset. Oh, you know what? There's another way to say one size federal government one size fits all mindset. You know what that is? Yeah, it's called equal protection of the law, and it's enshrined in the Constitution that the law means the same thing for everybody, male or female, black, white, brown, yellow, red, green, indifferent, sort of strangely peachy pink. Equal protection of the law for all people. Due process. procedural and substantive. Yeah, that's your one-size-fits-all federal government. We cannot allow Washington's tax and spend, one-size-fits-all mindset, to jeopardize our children's future, undermine our personal liberties, and drive our nation down a dangerous path to greater dependence of government. What does dependence of government mean? I mean, prepositions mean things too. Do they mean dependence on government, dependence for it, dependence of government? I don't get it. So I guess Rick Perry's not going to be calling out the Texas militia anytime soon to, maybe attack Fort Hood. I don't know if that's gotten through to Peter Morrison, the Republican treasurer of the Hardin County Republican Party. That's the guy who said the other night that he didn't want to live in the same country as Vermont and referred to Americans who disagree with him as maggots. God almighty. It's getting thick. But we have we have perhaps the beginnings of an understanding of why things are the way they are. This is a reality-based radio program, and we like to think that we have some regard for science. Like that science about the amygdala referenced earlier, the lizard brain. Well, there's a new report out about human cognitive abilities. It is a hypothesis generated and advanced by one Dr. Gerald Crabtree of Stanford University. That, of course, Stanford is in California. Communists! Dr. Gerald Crabtree says that human intelligence is on the decline. Now, there's no way of knowing if Dr. Gerald Crabtree sat down with a cold and frosty mug of root beer one evening and decided to watch Idiocracy and then decided to see if it would play out in science. We don't know that. But it certainly does parallel the assertions of that comedy, that biting piece of social satire that was so biting that it had to be set 500 years in the future. But Dr. Gerald Crabtree says we're getting dumber, and that we have been for some time. Dr. Gerald Crabtree, by the way, is a geneticist. He says, I would wager that if an average citizen from Athens of 1000 BC were to appear suddenly among us, he would be among the brightest and most intellectually alive of our colleagues and with a good memory, a broad range of ideas, and a clear-sighted view of important issues. Furthermore, I would guess that he or she would be among the most emotionally stable of our friends and colleagues. But it's not just Athens. Dr. Crabtree says the same could be said of people from Africa, Asia, India, or the Americas. Ultimately, without going into all the, you know, that science-y gobbledygook, Dr. Crabtree says that a whole bunch of the genes that control human intelligence and emotions are more susceptible than others to mutation. Mutation, of course, is the key to natural selection, and natural selection is, well, evolution. Well, we know how the teabaggers feel about that evolving. It looks like we've been on the downslide for about 5,000 years. It is possible, and if he is listening tonight, Dr. John might be fascinated by this, it is possible, according to this theory, that we peaked along about the time that we stopped being hunter-gatherers and started settling down to farming and making frisbees and wheat checks. Because you gotta be pretty damn smart to be a hunter-gatherer. You gotta be sharper than just about everybody else with whom you're competing. And while they had more leisure time, there was also less, room for error? I'm a little bit out of my depth here. But that's okay. Based on human current intellectual and emotional abilities, Dr. Crabtree speculates that our ancestors lived in a world where every individual, this is a quote, where every individual was exposed to nature's raw selective mechanisms on a daily basis. Whoa, I was wrong. The peak of human intelligence occurred about 50,000 to 500,000 years ago, when selective pressures were at their greatest. But still, 5,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, he says they were smarter then. It kind of explains the rise of authoritarianism, doesn't it? Another excerpt from the article. As humans moved from small bands of hunter-gatherers to dense agriculture-based societies, the survival of the fittest thankfully became less and less of an everyday reality. According to Crabtree, this transition had the side effect of taming natural selection. The lack of evolutionary pressures prevented adverse genetic mutations that slightly reduced humans' cognitive abilities from being eliminated. Dr. Crabtree said, one does not need to have visions of the world population docilely watching reruns on television they can no longer build. Remarkably, it seems that although our genomes are fragile, our society is robust almost entirely by virtue of education, which allows strengths to be rapidly distributed to all members. One wonders if Dr. Crabtree would agree when we say that in order to rapidly distribute that knowledge, one must believe, there's that word again, in education. Sick B. See how it works? Mrs. Solomon running over Mr. Solomon with her car because he didn't go out. I mean, Arizona went for Romney. It wasn't like he was out there in Ohio or Florida. Arizona went for Romney and she ran over him anyway. Jay pointing out who knows his Arizona, by the way. The first clue is the dateline is Arizona.
Yeah.
Marty noting, yeah, we know her politics. She's a conservative, soon to be a convict. Twoo, twoo, twoo. Some other stuff in the mailbag. Right quick. David in South Carolina, who sent the set B photo along, said, I would pay to watch a tea cracker spelling bee. Wouldn't we all? I before E, except in secede. Right? Well, apparently we got to Michael. Subject line merely says in all caps, sec D! You pinko liberals with your spelling, both of them E's look the same to me. How's a good Merkin supposed to know which one goes where? Valid point. Yes, you do, Irish Dave. If you think about it, you will remember the name of Rick Perry's ranch. It's a compound word, the second word of which is head. And no, the first word is not a nickname for Richard. Note coming in from Kevin on secession. Kevin writes, I really have no problems with some of these states seceding. But see, there is a problem because secession was forever forbidden by an act signed by President Andrew Johnson following the Civil War, and everybody agreed to it. Ain't nobody going to be seceding no more. That was supposed to have been an end to it. Source, of course, the ratification of the Constitution was supposed to have been one, too, but, well, some people are just cranky that way, generation after generation after generation. And Kevin says, I really have no problems with some of these states seceding, but signed in those secession agreements would be the following. One, a reasonable amount of time for those who either want to leave or join said state before the secession. Reparations shall be made to those property owners who are wishing to remain with the Union of at least two times the declared value of such property, whether it be land, buildings, or such other significant property that shall remain in the seceding state. Two, agreement between the U.S. government and the seceding state that there shall be no foreign aid to the seceding state for a period of at least 50 years. I'm thinking better 100. No aid in case of disaster, war, or any other negative thing affecting the said state. Three, seceding state shall return all property, weapons, etc. to the United States before seceding. Kevin says, the above should discourage most states from the thought of actually seceding, but if not, a very big and signed by the remaining citizens of the United States shall be sent to the seceding state, wishing them the best, a big card, wishing them the best of luck in their Randian adventure. They'll need it. Indeed they would. We understand historically that the Confederate states could never have survived had they forced some sort of independence, had there been some sort of separate peace, which was what they were going for at Gettysburg. They could never have survived. They would have, at best, become a sort of, probably ultimately, a crown colony of Great Britain. Oh, but they did have plans. They were going to conquer Cuba and Mexico, and they were going to conquer all of South America. It's all there. It's historic stuff. There are documents. Bill, Mr. Stress up in Cleveland. The wisdom of the Solomons? He didn't vote. I'm running down. Philip writes in, he says, face it, Bob, the husband's glad to be in the hospital. I'm sure he's feeling run down and tired. Philip's off and running. Run down and tired. and could use the rest. Any truth to the rumor that Governor Jan Brewer said that the number of tires was not important, that the wife could have run him over with two cars as well as with one? If she didn't, she's going to wish she had, Philip. I hate to poke fun, but being a teabagger in Arizona redefines redundancy for the majority of Arizonans, and one look into Michelle 1L Bachman's eyes tells me to live with a teabagger is to deal with insanity without the drugs. Or else be Marcus. Much as I'd like to let them go, we won't succeed if they secede. I guess I'm just a plain old patriotic Democrat who wants the country to hang together. Ironic when we find ourselves more overtly patriotic than the flag waver now secessionist Lee Greenwood fans. You know, that could be their, God bless the CSA, that could be their national anthem. What a political slogan for 2014. Union. Sexual or political, the Republicans hate it all. Vote Democrat. Goodness gracious, what a night. You know, we had a little dose of Pat Robertson last night. Pat is still upset. He was upset in the last clip because, well, he found out that there are women out there who like sexy stuff. Well, wouldn't you hate to live inside Pat Robertson's skull? Now Pat has found out, yeah, about what Beth in Dallas now refers to as High School Confidential, in other words, the emerging scandal of the David Petraeus affair. Let's run this down real quick, as best as I can understand it. Oh, by the way, Sandra just about hurt me this afternoon. I wasn't minding my own business when a tweet came through. Denver TV station going to try to do a little story on the evening news about the General Petraeus affair. Well, they put a picture of Ms. Wheelbarrow, or whatever his girlfriend's name was, up there on the Chiron. And then they had to go out on the interweb tubes, and you got to be real careful out on the interweb tubes, you really do. Because you can think that you're just getting an innocuous cover of her book, a shot of the cover of the book that she wrote about General Petraeus. You know, the one that was called All In, which is Orwellian enough in the first, but, well, Freudian enough. Don't cheat me, Bob, I'm on retainer. I know, Doc. Which was Freudian and All In. But it turns out that they screwed up and didn't look at the file as closely as they should have, Sec B, and instead posted a photograph of a slightly photoshopped copy of the book in which All In had been craftily changed to All Up In My Snatch. Yeah, really. Can't make this stuff up. Sandra tweeted that earlier today, and, well, I was not a well man. You know, when you're sitting there just minding your own business out in public, and all of a sudden you start laughing maniacally, folks tend to look at you funny. All Up In. Broadwell, that's your name. Not bus stop. So Ms. Broadwell sends emails to another woman who is the wife of a noted Tampa surgeon, and she's also kind of a military groupie, and apparently Ms. Broadwell is thinking that she might be in on the move, or on the make, so to speak, for the guy that she's philandering with, you know, General Petraeus. Well, it turns out that Ms. Kelly is, you know, the surgeon's wife. Well, it turns out that she has a friend in the FBI, and she turns the emails over to the friend in the FBI, and they weren't even that threatening. It wasn't like, you know, I'm going to get you or anything like that. You know, don't you think you're being a bit familiar with the general? Really now, darling? You know, something like that. So the friend in the FBI, in order to do a favor for the wealthy 1% lady, starts investigating. A while later, he starts from an anonymous email account, and when I told Agnes this part of the story, she laughed merrily. The FBI agent starts sending from an anonymous email account, mind you, and this is what made Agnes chuckle, shirtless photos of himself back to the woman on whose behalf he is investigating, Ms. Boardwalk. Broadwell. Sorry. And that gets him in hot water. And so they investigate, and it's frankly, it's BS. But they keep drilling down and drilling down until they access her, Ms. Backstop, or Broadwell, whatever, her other email account, and then they find the "Ooh, baby, I can't wait to bite your ankles" emails from General Petraeus. You were lovely in that filmy red thing, darling. You know, that kind of stuff. So that's how Petraeus's involvement comes to light. Meanwhile, the original FBI guy who was sending the shirtless photos of himself via the anonymous email account, and the shirtless photos kind of made it hard for him to be anonymous in. It's not like that black bar across the eyes really does anything, you know? He gets suspended, but not before they've dug far enough into the files to find out that groupie lady, who's married to the prominent surgeon in Tampa, was also apparently getting it on with yet another general. Ah, baby, you just sit back and relax, and Uncle Bucky will be there before you can say blast off. Yeah, my president needs me. What a bunch of clowns. So there's all of that. And yeah, Beth in Dallas has taken to referring to this as high school gun. It is no longer l'affaire Petraeus. It's not even worthy of the French. As Beth said, it's now high school confidential. There's more dignity in an episode of Glee. But anyway, yeah, I was getting to something. It turns out that having opined about women reading that raunchy stuff, Pat Brother Robertson, former liquor supply officer in some unit in the military, really, you know, his dad was a senator. It wasn't like he was going to march his ass back from Chosin Reservoir or anything. Liquor supply officer. Pat decided to explain to his ever-so-faithful viewers, I've come to the conclusion that most of the people who watch Pat Robertson are doing so now for the comic value. How could you not? I mean, really, listen.
So, Wendy, I hope they're not after you.
Not that I know of. Thanks. Well, congressional leaders are looking for answers to questions surrounding the resignation of David Petraeus from the CIA. Many want to know what the White House knew and when. And then there's the...
What? What is it about this story that says the White House had anything to do with it? Well, precisely nothing, but that never slowed down one of them lizard-brained, constantly devolving intelligence piglickens now. Did it? Yeah, I didn't think so either. What the White House knew... Yeah, because, right, this is some sort of sneaky trick by that one. You know, those blah presidents, you know, those anti-war, pro-government, presidents, they can be so slippery.
timing of Petraeus' resignation. It comes just as he was scheduled to testify about the terrorist attack that killed four Americans in Benghazi.
What, he can't testify anymore? Have they snipped off his junk and sewed his mouth shut? Subpoenas don't work on civilians? An oath administered to a civilian, it doesn't carry the same weight as an oath to administered to a general? I mean, I think the business he was getting into with Ms. Barnstorm, Broadwell, kind of negates that whole he was obsessed with duty, honor, and country thingy, doesn't it?
At the end of the day, the one thing...
Yes, do give us the lowdown, Senator Lindsey Graham Cracker.
The thing that has to happen, in my view, is we got to get to the bottom of Benghazi.
You hear that? You know what that sound is? That's the closet door opening long enough for Lindsey to talk.
I hate what happened to General Petraeus for his family and the families for those involved.
Ain't never going to happen with you, is it?
But we have...
Unless it's, of course, like a live boy or a dead boy.
Four dead Americans in Benghazi. We have a national security failure long in the making. I don't see how in the world you can find out what happened in Benghazi before, during, and after the attack if General Petraeus doesn't testify.
Why wouldn't he testify? I mean, he was director of the Central Intelligence Agency. He can still be... Or is this going to be like that thing with Ron Contra, where he's going to go out in his rowboat and have a stroke out in the middle of the pond? Remember Bill Casey? Yeah, me too. Getting ready to spill the beans on Ronnie, and he gets Fredo'd. Yeah, I always say three Hail Marys before I throw the line in, like some sort of animation out of a Monty Python skit.
The Petraeus testimony has now been put on hold. The acting CIA director will testify about Benghazi in a closed hearing Thursday. Pat, this is just a huge mess.
Oh, wait, so there is going to be testimony from the CIA about Benghazi. Oh, God, I smell an impeachment proceeding coming.
Well, I hope his resignation doesn't have anything to do with Benghazi. I don't think he's a devious human being. I think he's...
Wait. He hopes... There's that hoping. Hoping is almost as dangerous as believing. There he goes hoping again. He's hoping it doesn't have anything to do with Benghazi. Well, you know, there's some room for that hope. Because there's nothing to suggest it has anything to do with Benghazi. If Benghazi was even really an issue. Which it isn't.
He's been one of the greatest generals America's ever produced.
What?! David Petraeus is one of the greatest generals America has ever produced? David Petraeus is on a par with George freaking Washington? Well, okay, Britain produced him, really. I mean, when you get right down to it, he was a British subject. Yeah, but... Oh, okay. He's better than... He's right up there with Andrew Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans? He's up there with Meade at Gettysburg? He's up there with Patton and Omar Bradley? Really? Grant? What has he ever done to merit that kind of an accolade except for maybe, in Pat Robertson's world, register with the Republican Party?
He's a brilliant man. He's got a PhD from Princeton. And his analysis of counterinsurgency is the textbook for the whole military.
Yeah, that's why we didn't lose anybody in Iraq or Afghanistan. Right. Because, you know, he's a genius. Allow me to introduce myself. David Petraeus, super genius. I like the sound of that.
Sadly, miss a man like that. And how he was doing the CIA, nobody knows because he hadn't been integrated there long enough. It's amazing, though, that the affairs of the heart seem to catch these guys. But
Pat, buddy, we knew you were sort of flummoxed by porn. But this is not an affaire de coeur. by any stretch of the imagination. This is lust. This is an abuse of power. This is one of those situations that strikes one percenters, and yes, generals can be one percenters too. Most are. Where the lack of any real challenge left in life means that, well, if you're Michael Jordan, you make $100,000 bets on 3-foot putts. And if you're David Petraeus, you have a fling with your biographer, Mrs. Rumbleseat, the Broadwater. An affair of the heart. Was there ever a time when Pat Robertson referred to the so-called Lewinsky scandal as an affair of the heart?
I mean, this is a former, is a lieutenant colonel. She is an extremely good-looking woman.
Well, thank you for your opinion there, Pat. She's an extremely good-looking woman. I don't want to go the rest of the way with this. I just don't. Because you know what's coming. There's going to be some sexism in here somewhere. I mean, it's Pat Robertson. I can't understand why a woman would want to look at any of that there pornography.
She is a marathon runner. She'd run Ironman triathlons, and so she's running with him, and she's writing a biography. And
we know the name of the biography, right? Yeah, all up in.
I think the term is propinquity.
Oh, he says that like he just learned it.
There's a lot of propinquity going on.
I think a lot.
Is that what they call it now?
A lot. And, well, I mean, who knows? I mean, the man's off in a foreign land, and he's lonely, and here's a good-looking lady throwing herself at him. I mean, it's...
Throwing herself at him. It's never... Yeah. See, in right-wing religion industry, Eve bit the apple and screwed the goose for everybody else land. He has no responsibility. He didn't take out whatever may have been left of his honor and just pee all over it. She threw herself at him.
So, he's a man, so...
He's a man. You know, we do that. 37 years of marriage, and you're off in a foreign land, and here comes Mrs. Bilgewater, and... Broadwater. She throws herself. I mean, you know... And he's a man. And, you know, what's he supposed to do? I mean, she tripped it. They were walking down the garden path one day, and she tripped him and wound up and fell to the earth and beat him to the ground.
There are a number of people that felt he shouldn't have resigned if it didn't affect his work.
You know what? If the affair didn't affect his work, the divorce will, Pat. Honest to Pete. Do they just spend the rest of the day when he's not on air just shooting Aricept darts at his neck now? I don't know.
You know, as somebody said, think what would happen if Franklin Roosevelt had resigned during World War II because he had an affair. Others have had affairs, and Lyndon Johnson had serial affairs, and you go down the line and... You know, it's just the way it is. And I don't condone sexual immorality, but at the same time, I don't think it should be necessarily a disqualification for someone.
Unless you're the President of the United States and a Democrat, in which case you are in full-throated support of an impeachment proceeding and the attempt to remove said president from office. Notice how I didn't mention Bill Clinton? Yeah. Because, see, he's got a history. He's got a record. There's stuff you can look up about him on that. Oh, goodbye, Pat. And thanks to our friends at Right Wing Watch for doing what they do to get this all out there for us. Jack writing in from Shreveport. Bob, do you think as far as the issues surrounding the general and his all-in book that we've only gotten the tip of the story? Oh, stop it, Jack. Dr. John, with some follow-up information, he says, on the White House We the People site, strip the citizenship from everyone who signed a petition to secede and exile them, currently has 4,336 signatures. Of course, that's no more constitutional than the secessionist petition, says Dr. John, but I sort of like it in a, sure, I'll call your bluff and raise you sort of way. Yeah, I can see that. Strip, if you want to go to the petition site, it's the We the People site. Strip the citizenship from everyone who signed a petition to secede and exile them. They got 62,000 signatures on the Texas petition. They're approaching 25,000 on the Georgia petition. And they've only got 4,336 on this one. I look at this in the same light. Thanks, Dr. John. I look at this in the same light as that wonderful website, alldeadmormonsarenowgay.com. You know, that's the one where you can go and it'll just randomly select dead Mormons for you, and you can press a button, and they just like they baptize the dead, you can turn Mormons gay. This is like that. Michael says, did I catch Pat say about Petraeus at CIA that he hasn't been integrated there long enough? Is that because he was then part of the Mulatto administration as opposed to his old gig under Honky W? So he had to get all integrated? See, you were faster on the draw than Dr. Freud was, Michael. Philip with a note says, I'm opposed to secession, but if Texas and Arizona secede and Mexico moves to reclaim its stolen territory, I say let no arms from the United States and the secessionists aid the secessionists in attempting to preserve the independence of their alleged countries. For that matter, let Louisiana go too, but for New Orleans. If nothing else, the phrase Tex-Mex will have new significance, and it will give the Republicans in the former states a better opportunity to adjust to the coming majority in their former country. Vaya con Dios and all that, y'all. Also, no undocumented immigrants from the new countries, and we call them illegal because they're from illegal countries. Do you think the president will play George Strait's All My Exes Live in Texas as he waves farewell? Does Petraeus' affair mean the Republicans no longer are considering him for president? The horror. Colin Powell endorsed Obama, and now Petraeus endorses infidelity. A year of disappointment and military defeats all around for our Republican friends. To be undone first by the general election and now by the general erection. Sorry, Bob. Signed, Philip. That's pretty good. Beaten in the, yeah, that's high quality. Beaten in the general election and now by the general erection. It goes on and on and on. Paul Ryan. We got a Paul Ryan story. We've got let's see. What else? Okay, yeah, dealt with that. I don't have the heart to subject you to Limbaugh audio this evening. It is funny though. And, like I said. Oh, one last thing, since it is Titanic Tuesday. And since we have been talking about General Petraeus. Remember last night's story about the members of SEAL Team 6 who sold out their country in order to get the free unlock download extra pack for Medal of Honor warfighter. I mean, we don't know what they were paid, but they were paid to sell out national security information to a video game company. It's pretty interesting. It turns out that, I don't know, are video games now the reflection of our national culture? Because on the heels of that story about the sellout to Medal of Honor warfighter, well, the other big deal game, and it came out today, is Call of Duty Black Ops 2. another shoot 'em up. Yeah. For your various gaming platforms and probably your computer as well. Guess who is Secretary of Defense in 2025? In Call of Duty Black Ops 2. That's right, General Petraeus. Really? Oh, that's going to be a dandy. Well, I guess he won't be having his, no. I don't know, by 2025, you think maybe he will have been forgiven? Video games. I think we better start paying more attention. So there you have it. The evening's filibobster. We'll get some conversation in here shortly, and then 8 p.m. our good buddy Jeff Biggers will be stopping by, telephonically at least. You know how to reach the program, right? Number's 304-658-3333. On Skype, the handle is Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, Horn. And you can just jump right in. We've got the Green News Report coming up from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. We are listener-supported here at the Horn. Many thanks to all of you who contribute month by month by month to keep this going. If you haven't lately and you'd like to do so and be a part of the ongoing experiment and conversation, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the snail mail address under the tab Contribute. Take a little break and come back. I'm Bob Kincaid, and this is The Horn. Call it 15 rounds to
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
It's Tuesday, October 13, 2012.
Elections have consequences.
We want our children to live in America that isn't threatened by the destructive power of a warming planet.
Obama talks climate change, but will he and can he deliver? Grover Norquist versus the Koch brothers. The U.S. projected to become the Saudi Arabia of oil. Plus,
this was cataclysmic for New York.
Superstorm Sandy was very expensive.
All of that and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Debbie Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
Let me get this right. So all the record temperatures throughout the America this year, all the severe droughts and land burning up, and now the severe storms, is that not climate change? Turns out, gays.
Oh, I knew it was the gays. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, well, we're back after taking a week off to cover the elections. I trust there was no green news at all that happened over the past week.
Oh, yeah, there was nothing really important to cover. But we will, by the way, have plenty of catch-up on our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
What do you got for us today?
Well, first, this happened.
But despite all our differences, most of us share certain hopes for America's future. We want our children to live in America that isn't threatened by the destructive power of a warming planet.
The destructive power of the what?
He's talking about climate change.
Who was that guy?
There. Yeah, I know. That's President Obama in the middle of his victory speech on election night. He actually referred to global warming for the first time in ages. And that was for the first time in a speech that a lot of Americans actually saw. But the question now is, will he and can he deliver? With the Republican majority in the House of Representatives, there is only so much that he can do. Very soon, Obama will have to make a final decision on whether to approve the controversial Keystone XL tar sands pipeline from Canada. More immediate is the looming expiration of the crucial wind energy production tax credit that expires in December. The U.S. wind industry warns that 37,000 workers will lose their jobs immediately if it's not renewed. The Republican majority in the House is against renewing the wind energy tax credit, even as they favor keeping billions in annual permanent oil industry subsidies.
Now, they were against renewing the wind tax credit before the election. Are they still against it even after the election?
Very much so. It seems like they're going to try to use it as a bargaining chip.
Message not received.
Now, some groups have floated the idea of a carbon tax as these so-called fiscal cliff negotiations get underway on Capitol Hill. A carbon tax on heat-trapping carbon emissions would force polluters to pay for their pollution and fund clean energy projects, and it would also reduce the deficit by bringing in an estimated $150 billion a year in new revenue. Even Grover Norquist of Americans for Tax Reform was open to the idea of a carbon tax. He said on Monday that it wouldn't violate his anti-tax pledge, that is, until American Energy Alliance, a Koch brothers front group, smacked him down hard, saying, quote, Grover, just butch it up and oppose this lousy idea directly.
Wow. Now, yeah. Now, we should tell folks that the carbon tax was the more progressive way to deal with greenhouse gases, but in trying to compromise, the Obama administration and Democrats had gone along with the idea of cap and trade, which was initially a Republican idea until the Republicans decided they didn't like it anymore either. So
right.
Now we may go back to the more progressive idea of just a direct carbon tax.
Well, it's possible, but the White House says that President Obama has no plans at this point to introduce a carbon tax. We'll see what happens. The United States could overtake Saudi Arabia as the world's biggest oil producer by the year 2020. That's according to the International Energy Agency in their annual World Energy Outlook report. Based on current trends, the Paris-based IEA projects that the U.S. would be a net exporter of oil by 2030. That's because of unconventional drilling techniques like hydraulic fracturing and projected improvements in energy efficiency like Obama's new mileage standards for cars. But the IEA report also acknowledges that this would be dangerous for the climate, saying that no more than a third of those proven reserves of fossil fuels could be burned if we want to avoid global temperatures from rising beyond the 2 degrees Celsius limit that's been recommended by the global scientific community. Meanwhile, climate change is on the mind of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in the aftermath of Superstorm Sandy.
We have to make sure that we're prepared for when this happens again.
In a press conference on Monday, Governor Cuomo said he will seek $30 billion in additional federal aid from Congress to rebuild New York City's aging infrastructure to withstand future extreme weather impacts due to climate change.
It's a wise investment for the federal government to help us build this economy back. The sooner we get the New York economy running, the better for this state and this nation.
Building resilience into New York City's infrastructure will cost tens of billions of dollars, but that's still cheaper than the $60 billion in losses caused by Superstorm Sandy.
For more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, please consider a donation to help sponsor the Green News Report. We rely on you to stay on your public airwaves. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head-on with Bob Kincaid.
Minutes past the hour on the horn this Titanic Tuesday, 13th day of November 2012. I'm Bob Kincaid. And we will go to the conversation portion of Conversation Radio straight away. In the order in which they were received, we go to, let me get this, someday I'll have a producer. We'll go to Skype where Tracy's waiting. Hey, Tracy.
How the hell are you?
Oh, there you are.
Come on, not again. Oh, no. You hear me now?
Yeah, it's working.
Okay, cool. I'm in my in technology, not so much, but. So I'm listening to Pat Robertson. Was it just me, or did he sound like the Crypt Keeper?
Oh yeah, he's just gross. But he's fun. But he's fun too. Like I said, I think the majority of his audience is now tuning in just for the comic value.
Just to hear what he's going to say. Okay. So like he's basically. So is he one of the people that were through? President Clinton under the bus because,
No. Pat didn't throw President Clinton under the bus. Pat wanted to run over President Clinton with the bus.
Okay. And so, but that's right. Since he was a Democrat. So it's okay. Is it one of those things, do as I say, not as I do?
No, it's one of those things, I-O-K-I-Y-A-R.
Okay.
It's okay if you're a Republican.
Okay, because
because if he had been a registered Democrat, registered Democrat and a general, Pat would be out there screaming for a court martial, a whipping at the mast, firing squad, I don't know, the Chuck Connor, broken sword treatment from the opening credits of Branded, whatever. Tear the buttons off his blouse, that kind of, right.
The sheer hypocrisy of the whole thing, look, I don't care what people do in their private lives. The only time I care about what you do in your private life as if, you know, what you do is going to affect my life. Like, you know, or it's something terrible like, you know, sleeping with kids or dogs. Or, you know, but when two grown folks, you know, get together and do what they got to do, and let's face it, I'm awful, but I had no idea what General Petraeus' wife looked like, and they showed the picture of her, and I'm like, ooh. That's not...
They've been married for 37 years. He looks like a guy who's been married for 37 years, and she looks like a long-suffering military wife who's been married for 37
years. 37 years. And nothing, you know, I cannot stand this because it's like, you know, I look at her, people like her and John McCain's wife, the first Mrs. McCain.
Yes.
And how, wasn't she, you know, she stuck by her man, and then he got one little piece of the action. Oh, and also I hear that.
I'm sorry, you're breaking up. Hey, Tracy. Tracy, you're breaking up.
About the whole situation. Oh, wait, hold on. I heard that they were interviewing. Hold on.
I got a feeling, Tracy, that your processor is overtasked. Yeah, we lost you. Doggone it, we hate that. But it's Skype, and she can bounce back in. We'll keep it rolling. Hey, welcome to the program.
What's up, Butch?
You are. What's happening, Jim?
No, you are. I mean, come on. We're talking about, oh, I love my wife, oh, you kid, that type thing, aren't we?
Not another Schnitzelgruber, honey. I'm not from Havana.
No, whatever. I mean, look, you know, this thing about Petraeus, I mean, Washington, I've lived there. I've seen this shit go on and on and on, and people jumping and bed hopping and stuff like that.
Yeah, well, it's turning. I mean, this now there's another general involved.
Well, look at General Eisenhower. While he was leading D-Day, he was having an affair with his driver, Kay Summersby. Hello.
Yep. Eisenhower wasn't among the philandering presidents that Pat Robertson mentioned? I wonder why that is.
Oh, maybe Pat didn't get another heiress that dark. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have enough time, or maybe he didn't. I don't know. But that's the first thing I thought about. Was Kay Summers being Eisenhower?
Sure.
Because she wrote her memoirs after that. But she had the decency to keep it quiet.
Right.
Of course, they didn't have Gmail and stuff like that, and people started sending all these intimate messages on Gmail and stuff like that, thinking it's secure, are absolutely nuts.
Well, the whole thing is becoming rather fascinating, because had it not been for the fact that the FBI agent apparently had a bit of a crush on Ms. Kelly.
Oh, God.
Because, after all, he was sending the shirtless photos to her. Other people who have seen the emails from Ms. Bongwater to Ms. Kelly have said, you know, there's none of that business about, you know, I'm going to get you or get your hands off of my man or any of that stuff. It was no.
Well, you know, in order to Titanic your Tuesday, may I ask you one thing? I mean, what is the sexual arithmetic of Washington have to do with all this stuff? To me, it's a non-issue.
It would be. I mean, consider that the Republican leadership in the House knew about this before the president did.
Well, I'm sure the president probably had suspicions before they did. I mean, you know, he has his sources, let me tell you. They're not stupid. They know what's going on. I mean, I've been through enough security stuff to realize that people tap your phones and follow you around and stuff like that, and put little bugs in your car, see if you leave within X number of miles of D.C. and who you're going to go see. I've been through all that, Bob. Seen it. Not that I was ranked that high, but I knew about it, heard about it, and dealt with enough people who are friends of mine in agencies who did to know. That's the way it is when you get inside the Beltway, and even 25 miles or so outside the Beltway.
Yeah, Ray just writing in with that quote from Dr. Strangelove. You can't carry on like this. I've never seen such behavior. Gentlemen, this is the war room.
Like I said before, please send me the cliff notes on your filibuster. I wasn't able to keep it straight.
Well, I was a little lost along the way, too, Jim.
Oh, you were loving every minute of it? No, you were.
Well, no, I mean, really? Shirtless photos of FBI agents sent to military groupies in... What?
Well?
Like I said, there's more dignity in an episode of Glee.
Well, I mean, you know, were they attractive, or were they just some guy with sagging tits?
No, I mean, these are I get, you know, the one man's nightshirts is another man's, but... reasonably well-preserved, good-looking 30-something women.
Oh, Lord have mercy. I don't know why in the world people feel this need.
Now, I mean, I'll tell you, Agnes looked at both women and said, what? But, you know, Agnes is my, she's my bellwether on this kind of thing.
Bellwether.
I trust her judgment on things like, wait a minute. And then when I told her, that when she found out that General Petraeus had been married for 37 years, she said, oh, that philandering note, and then a bunch of words that, well.
Well, you know, hey, it goes on both sides. You've got women who do the same thing as their husbands, and vice versa.
Well, there's there's even some speculation out there. I don't know if you caught this or not.
Now, wait a minute. Hear me out.
All right.
You know, I'm going to come down on the side of General Petraeus, okay?
All right.
I tried to send you an email last night about how I respected the service of our military men and women. And this guy had a flawless career, not flawless, but a very good career in the military. He made a mistake, just like so many of our leaders have made mistakes. And we can go to Bill Clinton, we can go to the late Senator Kennedy, and so many others. And what really bothers me is the fact that we get all head up about it. I don't like that.
Well,
I know what it's like to have your personal life examined and have somebody else who is your enemy try to make some type of political or career capital out of it. And I don't like it.
All right, Jim, calm down.
No, I'm fine.
No, you're not. Fine. You're hollering.
No.
Now, the fact of the matter is...
No, my phone was accelerating. Pardon me.
Well, yeah, okay. The fact of the matter is General Petraeus held himself up as some sort of marble man for the modern age. And when you do, I mean, if you're a libertine, you know, fine. If you're a George Patton, you know, mavericky whatever, okay.
Oh, Patton was involved in that, too.
But the point being that Petraeus has been held up as some sort of military genius when he's not. He tried to strong arm the President of the United States back in 2009. That's documented. As far as the so-called surge in Afghanistan is concerned, you remember Colonel David Hackworth, since passed on, brilliant commentator. Rose from the rank of private in World War II to the rank of colonel. I mean, you know, a soldier kind of guy. I went digging around last night and I found a reference where Hackworth had referred to folks like Petraeus as perfumed princes. And that's, you know, this is one of the, this, you know, Petraeus was a climber, not a leader. And, you know, if you go back and read, for instance, that Rolling Stone article that was done about him. You know, his hubris was monumental. And the whole thing about hubris is that it will bring you down.
Well, Bob, I've known a lot of four-star generals who have a lot of that and who have a lot of, you know, you can't touch me type of attitude. That's just the way they get. And what have I always said about the military to you? It is a corporation. And General Petraeus was the CEO of that corporation. And I think that.
But most corporations are not predicated on essentials like duty, honor, and country.
Well, I don't know.
I mean, I've never known duty, honor, and country to motivate the workings of, let's say, ExxonMobil.
Well, as far as the loyalty they demand of their employees are concerned, the same principles apply within that corporation. Now, that's for damn sure. Or you're out on your ass.
Well, as long as you're making money and play the internal corporate politics,
right.
Yeah.
But
I mean, David Petraeus, just in terms of history, we have to take him into account with things like ethnic cleansing in Iraq, the sleazy business that was involved in the so-called Iraqi surge, when basically he very cynically conned the Sunnis into thinking that he was on their side and then turned the Shia loose to slaughter them. I mean, just nasty, nasty business.
Well, yeah, you can dig up a lot of stuff on anybody you want to, and you know, what you say is, I'm not arguing with, what you say is, I say, correct, we talked about it before. But look at the corporate people who have done the same thing. By way of, vis-a-vis, military heads of organizations. It's all intertwined. It really is. But, you know, getting off that subject, may I change the subject just for a second?
Oh, sure.
When your guest comes on. You were talking last night about some kind of drug test or whatever.
Oh, yeah, the dried urine. It's not even urine. That was the fascinating thing about it. You had mentioned that there are cleanses out there, and this is not a cleanse.
Well, I don't know.
This is actual synthetic urine.
Yeah, but why bother to go through all these artificial devices and stuff like that when you can just take TestClear? It's right on the Internet, and it's been in business for years. It was made one time by the Zion.Dot Corporation. I don't know if they're still in business or not. But I knew a guy who was a commercial truck driver, and before he would take the test for DOT, we would go to an adult bookstore where they sold this stuff, $35. Guy didn't have a lot of money.
Oh, they sell cleanses now at GNC in the mall. That's one of their hottest sellers.
Is it?
Oh yeah. Because it's not very often you go to the vitamin store to pick up some ester C or some fish oil for your omega-3 fatty acids or whatever, and you look over and something is locked behind, is under key behind glass. And I was like, what the hell is that? And the proprietor, the clerk said, oh, that's the urine cleanse. We have to keep it locked up or people just steal it left and right. And the shit was $50 a bottle.
That's gone up $15 since the 80s. My God. Well, I guess, you know.
Well, you got to keep up with inflation.
You got to keep up with inflation. And, you know, that's one thing I wanted to make a point on was TestClear, and it will guarantee a positively good result for someone who is taking it with X number of liters of water.
Of course, in the case of last night's story, these were mine workers in Australia, and I don't know if that stuff is on the market down there. So that may be, but the fact that they've made the scientific progress, Jim, to come up with synthetic urine. I mean,
well, I'm sure they can probably use that to some type of good, because they always do develop some type of spinoff from stuff like that.
And the idea that it, for those who have to be watched. That it even comes with a prosthesis? See, aren't you proud of me? I said prosthesis.
I know.
I am capable of restraint, Jim.
Oh, I know, Bob. I know you are. Bless your heart. By the way, going back to secession in Calhoun and stuff like that with South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it really wasn't per se secession. It was nullification.
Well, nullification was the issue, and secession was the stated remedy.
Well, the first person who got the news on that was guess who? John C. Calhoun.
Yeah.
Jackson's own vice president. And he said, you do this, and I will, and this is a quote right from the book, I will hang you higher than Haman.
Exactly.
There it is, and there you have it. So,
but
anyway,
what Andrew Jackson did seemed to calm things down for a couple of decades. They came to an understanding over nullification.
Well, they came to a number of qualifications over, like, the anti-fugitive slave law and other things like that that calmed the South down.
Right, because basically they gave in to the South on a lot of them.
Well, they had to, because guess what? The South was their major supplier. And Northern industry needed Southern cotton and Southern goods. So it was an economic thing. And I'm not trying to burst anybody's bubble here, but there were a number of economic aspects to that uneasy relationship.
Oh, the cynicism of economics was on display.
Other than William Lloyd Garrison and the abolitionists and things like that. What I'm trying to say is this. You know, the North was not that sensitive in many cases, nor was Abraham Lincoln.
No, Lincoln is on record, Jim. Lincoln said, if I could restore the Union without freeing the slaves, I would do that.
Yeah, exactly, and he used it as a very brilliant tactical maneuver in 1863 to disrupt the consistency and the ability of the Confederacy to continue prosecuting the war.
And in fact, it is that decision-making process that is at the center of the new movie by Steven Spielberg that's out. Lincoln.
Yes, I know.
And I'm looking forward to seeing that film.
And, you know, Lincoln was a great man in many ways. There's no question about that. But he was a total and complete pragmatist.
And very much a man of his times. I mean, prior to his assassination, and once it was clear that the war was lost on the southern side, they began to contemplate, you know, how they would go about dealing with freedom. And you know, one of the things that Lincoln thought was a great idea was let's sail everybody back to Africa, you know, the Liberia colony.
Yeah, Monrovia and all that stuff like that. But you know, interestingly enough, Bob, there were a lot of plots on the northern side to assassinate Jefferson Davis. And they still haven't quite figured out who started what as far as that particular action was concerned.
And yet the northern government, Lincoln himself, in contemplating it before his death, was in a real quandary over what to do with Jefferson Davis.
Well, I think,
you know, do we capture him and try him?
Well,
or do we let him go?
Well, eventually they let him go.
Yeah.
And as they did other members of, you know, the Confederacy. And let's face it, there was enough evidence on who shot John to convict just about everybody, because that was a real dirty war, politically and in every other way.
Well, I'm not aware historically, and I doubt you are either, of very many, well, let's put it this way, it is oxymoronic to refer to internecine bloodshed as a civil war. They are the least civil of any wars.
Well, that's what people call them, civil war, and it means within.
It means the breakdown of the civic state.
Yeah, internecine means within. So it was a war within our own country. But nonetheless, you know, I just thought I would point that out. And on that note, I'm going to leave you where I found you, and I hope that you have a very good interview with your upcoming guest.
Well, Jeff's a great friend, and he's always a great conversation. Thank you, Jim, and have a good evening.
Same to you.
Bye now. And that's Jim. And onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob.
Hey, what's happening, Kevin?
Oh, not much. I just was thinking about all of what's happened here in the past few days. And has it only been a week since the election?
Found myself thinking the same thing, Kevin.
Yeah, it seems like a month. 10 has passed since last Tuesday night. it's interesting about this Petraeus thing, because apparently a lot of people were thinking that he couldn't justify, since he's now a civilian, and there is such a thing as a congressional subpoena, and as far as I know, I think it's...
Right. I mean, that was... All of that, Kevin, is just the weird paranoia of the right wing. General Petraeus was done in, see, because he was going to come and spill the beans on that one, because that communist socialist Kenyan Muslim with the deep-seated anti-colonialist tendencies who hates white people, he set up Benghazi all by himself. He was he's probably the guy that fired the round that killed our ambassador. I mean, that's how sick and paranoid they are, Kevin. I can't say exactly that's been said, but if you go wander around on some of the weirder right-wing sites, you probably would find something pretty close to it.
And I'll bet you Alex Jones already has a video out about it.
I was just thinking of, that's when I said weirder right-wing, yeah. And yeah. It's only $27.95.
Yep, pretty sad, but that's why I said that I'm necessarily not opposed to a couple of these states leaving.
But it's illegal now.
Sure.
I mean, it was made expressly illegal.
Right, but
we're all married up, and there ain't no divorces.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that.
In order for secession to really take place. It wouldn't even be secession, because you would have to have a complete functional breakdown of the federal government.
Right. Well...
And that's why I've said that something like that, what I refer to as the Balkanization of the North American continent, probably won't come along for about 250 years or so. And then you'll have a nation that's made up of, like, New Mexico, Arizona, Washington, Oregon, California, and then you'll have all the weirdo Confederate states, and then the states across the Great Lakes and into the Northeast, and there's kind of a joker in the deck with the Mid-Atlantic states.
Well, I don't know. I've always wondered, because, okay, it's illegal to secede from the Union, but if a state really did want to secede from the Union, what would stop them from actually seceding? Now, I know the federal government would stop them by force, you know, in terms of military force to keep them in the Union, but there's nothing...
Well, remember, among other things, the National Guard is no longer the state militia. The National Guard can be federalized at the stroke of a pen.
Right.
So,
done that out of,
I mean, it's, yeah. It was 1861. 1860 and 1861 are a very different time from now. But, you had overt acts of... An overt act of military aggression perpetrated by a southern state subsequent to articles of secession having been approved by their legislatures. But what I find much more interesting, Kevin, is the degree to which these white wingers want to bring the topic up. Because it tells you a little bit, and maybe for people who have never lived in the South, and I know you were in Florida for a time, right?
Oh, I grew up in Florida, yeah.
Yeah, did you grow up in Redneck Florida or South Florida?
Tampa.
Okay, so the six of one and a half dozen of another.
Kind of in between.
People who are not intimately familiar with the life of the South don't understand that the war has never ended.
No.
I mean,
no.
Granted, if you go through towns in the upper Midwest or the Midwest, you know, you'll see their statues on their courthouse lawns of their Union soldiers. But they're not nearly as obsessed with it as the South is.
No. No.
You know, things like Memorial Day. The first Memorial Day, we celebrate Memorial Day as a national holiday when we honor our fallen war dead. The first Memorial Day was a creature of the brainchild of Southern women honoring the dead of the Confederacy.
Right.
So the southern states are much more invested in the history of that era, and you could argue much more invested in their history generally, but especially of that era, and you know, the notion of the failed cause, all of which was invented subsequent to the Civil War. There was none of that BS being talked at the time secession was being talked. It was grave and deadly, bloody business, and they knew it.
Right.
Because a great number of Southern leaders says, "Listen, you know we're going to get our asses whipped, right?" "Yes, but it is necessary to defend our freedom." You know, by our freedom they meant our white freedom. Because
right.
Well, right, there was.
And no, it was.
But all this talk about secession, Kevin, just tells us the degree to which it is still very much on the minds of Southern people. How many generations after?
Well,
I mean,
sure.
You know,
never,
I'm 50, and you know, I've got to go back at least five great grandfathers to get to 1860.
Yep. Well, number one, they never have given up the war. They may have signed the surrender papers at Appomattox, but in a lot of people's minds, they never surrendered. Lee was the one that signed those papers, not them.
Oh, no, I mean, there were pockets of insurrection that continued and had to be put down, especially west of the Mississippi.
And as far as today, you can go through any number of southern towns, and you know this from being in Alabama. People have got the Confederate flags on the back of their pickup trucks and sign in the back window that says "Surrender Hell."
Yeah, forget hell. Yeah, which goes hand in hand, among other things, and I don't think a lot of people necessarily make the connection, Kevin, but goes hand in hand with the gun culture that obtains in this country today.
Yep.
Because there are a lot of people that think they're going to go get the .30-06 out of the gun rack and protect themselves against the overreaching of the federal government.
What was it?
I mean, it was 100 years, Kevin, before Independence Day was ever again celebrated in Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Yep.
Because the 4th of July was the day that Vicksburg surrendered.
Yep.
See, the South lost Vicksburg and Gettysburg roughly on the same day.
Yep.
July the 4th, 1863. I saw somebody tweet, and I think I retweeted it or something this past week, you know, the Alabama Crimson Tide got beaten by Texas A&M, and I saw somebody out there that said between Alabama losing to Texas A&M and Obama winning the election, this is the worst week Alabama's had since July of 1863.
Probably some truth to that.
Well,
the way they take their football down there, but for people who've never been to the South, it is a unique culture because it just, they never have forgotten, and now that they have this black man in the White House, they can't accept that their days, figuratively, if not literally, are numbered.
From the time the first shiploads of kidnapped Africans arrived on the shores of the United States, or what was then colonies, Kevin, the white man has been in desperate... Well, no, from the moment the white man appeared on these shores, we have lived in desperate fear because we've always been a minority population.
Right.
You know, all this talk of a white majority in the United States it's a figment of people's imagination.
Yep.
And so it was necessary to come up with various and sundry means of suppressing rights and suppressing dignity and suppressing humanity itself. And while, for instance, the South is very much fascinated with its own history, it is not nearly as fascinated with learning the lessons of it. And the lesson, you know, because the lesson for the South is not y'all lost the war and therefore blah blah. The lesson is y'all ought not have started the war in the first place. And that has not fully gotten through. And it seems the further in time we get from it, the more some of that crap entrenches itself. I mean, my God, I ran into a woman on Facebook the other day who professed to be a liberal and a progressive and sat there and swore up and down that slavery was not the root cause of the Civil War. What can you do with a person? You know, and she bragged about her prestigious Eastern Academy education, blah, 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 blah.
Well, I've heard that through my time in growing up in the South, that slavery really wasn't the cause of the Civil War.
No, it was about states' rights. It was about economics. It's what it was about.
And you'll hear them talk sort of proudly about how there were black men that fought for the Confederacy during the war. Well, I'm sure there were, but I doubt they did it willingly. You know, if someone...
Well, yeah, and bear in mind that a number of Southern nobles brought along their body servants.
Yep. And I don't know. This whole thing with Petraea, it all just seems to be meshing together. You know, that's why I have this feeling that the election was a month ago, because I didn't get to bask in the afterglow of Obama winning for more than a day and a half, I think. And
oh, no, that was taken away right quick.
You know, and as far as people not learning the lessons, the Republicans haven't learned the lesson of this defeat. Not by any means. I can't think who the person was that said it, but they're blaming their conservative for not being conservative. They're blaming Romney for not being conservative enough. Totally missing.
Well, and they're blaming him for not being pro-fetus enough. They're not being... anything except the real cause, which was
right.
That they are at, that the entire structure is completely out of sync with anything resembling reality.
Well, it's another thing that they're having to struggle, cope with, and come to grips with is that religiously we ain't buying it, politically we ain't buying it, and economically. We're not buying it. And when you've got the number of voters that came out for this election and voted for Obama, and Romney got less votes than McCain in 08.
He got less Mormon votes.
Exactly. Well, he lost all three of his home states. That should tell you something right there.
No, he didn't. He didn't lose Utah.
I heard that he did. I heard that it was, what was it, Michigan, Massachusetts.
No, but he didn't. He didn't lose Utah. But he did get less Mormon votes than McCain did. Hey, Kevin, I got to roll because we've got a great conversation coming up. But I look forward to us talking again.
Yeah, looking forward to hearing this.
All right, see you. Bye.
Care.
Sir, buddy Kevin, we are right up on top of the hour. Jeff Biggers to be joining us shortly, I hope. We'll take a little break and come back, hopefully, with Jeff Biggers. You're listening to America's listener-supported liberal voice, America's source for this little thing we've invented called conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
And the band's bumping rhythm and blues. Gonna steal a little. Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
2 minutes past the hour. I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. And as promised, early in the program, and just a few minutes ago as well, we are joined at this point in time by my good friend and good friend of The Horn, journalist and human rights activist, Jeff Biggers. Jeff is on the road and has called in this evening to talk a little bit about some of the underreported vote suppression shenanigans, among other topics, going on in Arizona. Jeff is the author of the recently released book, State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown over the American Dream. It's a magnificent book, and I've got it on my Kindle. And it really shows that Arizona is both a laboratory for right-wing oppression as well as the hopes of those who oppose it. Jeff Biggers joins us now. Jeff, thank you so much.
Great to be back, Bob. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. You've documented human rights abuses in Appalachia with the United States and the proud history as well with the United States of Appalachia. The new book, State Out of the Union. Tell us, where did you get the motivation to work this side of the street?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I sort of stumbled into it. Largely out of growing up and emerging my own self out of these communities, this other America, this other history that I often felt, you know, I never read about myself as a child. I grew up in Southern Illinois, you know, in the coal fields, as you know, as I chronicled my book Reckoning at Eagle Creek, and then as a child, we moved out to Tucson, and so I grew up in Tucson. My father was deeply involved in a lot of movements in the barrio, in the Chicano movement. And I think what was important to me growing up is to realize that so much of our history is not told, it's not chronicled, especially those who have faced oppression, those who are up against the system, up against, you know, the multinational corporations that have been throwing our states around. And this is really exactly what I found in my last book, State Out of the Union, is that the battle that we're seeing today in Arizona is a battle we've been fighting for over 100 years, 150 years, ever since Arizona's inception as a territory and then its state 100 years ago. And it's really been a battle between big extraction companies like the copper companies in Arizona or the coal companies in Appalachia and the people, the laborers, the community people, the rooted people, the indigenous people who have been forced in a position to fight back. And so my role as a historian, as a journalist on the front lines is to tell their story, to give a place for their voices. And, you know, I feel like my work is really on the shoulders of people like Fed Circle and Howard Zinn in that way.
And of course, you were early on mentored by the late, great Don West as well, right?
Right. The Appalachian historian and poet and community activist. And, you know, I think you're right in that, you know, rarely am I introduced as sort of a human rights activist. It's either a journalist, and I don't often feel as if I'm a journalist, but more as a cultural historian. But I do see myself ultimately as a human rights or civil rights activist. But that drives a lot of my work, is that there are injustices, and we have to capture them and provide the cultural and historical context of why we're having to face them today. And be it Appalachia, or be it out west, or be it abroad, I feel like ultimately that's been my role, really as a civil rights activist.
Well, you've done a magnificent job, and we, of course, became friends as a result of your work in Appalachia and documenting the abuses via surface mining and the mining industry and mountaintop removal. And, of course, it was all chronicled what you knew from your youth in southern Illinois in Reckoning at Eagle Creek. And I don't know how many folks know that you have that connection that you just described with Arizona. But when you saw all the SB 1070 and all the repressive conduct going on, you were simply drawn back to more of your roots, right?
Right. You know, in the spring of 2010, I was talking to you on The Horn, as always, about coal mining in Appalachia, my own southern Illinois, in my last book, Reckoning at Eagle Creek. And I kept getting these calls and emails saying, hey, you got to come home. There's another battle here that needs your voice, that needs you to be there to chronicle what we're doing. And at first I was shocked. You know, it was very difficult to be working in other communities when your own community is under assault. And, of course, I've always felt that with the Heartland. I've spent a lot of my life outside in other communities defending other people. And this is one of those situations where you felt like you really had to go home, and I did. You know, I went back to Tucson in the summer of 2010. I put myself into the front lines working with people who are both working against the SB 1070, which is the Papers, Please immigration law, people who are working in body of defense communities, people who are working against the outlawing of Mexican-American studies. And I really just began to slowly immerse myself in what I had grown up in. And it was a real homecoming, Bob, I got to tell you. You know, I think you probably know me better than anybody. I'd spent years battling Big Coal, and now I needed to go back and fight the same sort of situation where you had outside interlopers, outside carpetbaggers, extraction companies, corporate powers and corporate lobbies. In this instance, we're talking about the private prison lobby and other sort of nefarious groups, and how they were ultimately manipulating and manufacturing a crisis that didn't exist, really wasn't taking place, to ram through an even more radical agenda. So it was really a homecoming for me.
Well, I'm really glad to see State Out of the Union out there, Jeff, because it seems that the great majority of so-called journalism or reportage or whatever has been on the, and of course you want a spotlight shown on this, has been on the excesses of the right wing in Arizona, but there has not been that body of reporting, at least that I've seen, on the dedicated and concerted resistance to it, and that you know, tell us a little bit about the people that you that you've met, for instance, this what caused me to contact you in the first place. This voter, the obvious voter suppression that took place in Arizona in this last election, we wouldn't know anything about that if there was not a serious core group of very dedicated individuals trying to stop it. And so you're bringing that to light, and I think the folks, the Horn family, would like to know a little bit more about it.
Right. I mean, that's a really good point, is that, you know, Arizona has always had two sides. I did a piece in the New York Times called The Arizonification of America, Not Quite What You Think. You know, I think we think of Arizonification of America as the great Tea Party takeover. You know, and of course, the copycats from SB 1070 went around the country. You had 25 different states that tried it. Of course, Alabama, Georgia. You know, your dear Alabama, of course, had an even worse law, went all the way up to New Hampshire. And I always said it wasn't a state policy, it was a state of mind. It was a law of the state of mind that allowed us to sanction racial profiling, to allow multinational corporations to push us around and criminalize immigrants for very opportunistic reasons. It was really part of a greater Tea Party agenda that had descended and used Arizona as a petri dish. And I kept saying, but this is not my Arizona. Just as I said many, many years ago, you know, Don Blankenship is not Appalachia to me, that there was another Appalachia, a very progressive Appalachia. And so I had to go back and find that other progressive Arizona that had been fighting back. And I was really both surprised and shocked by what I found. You know, historically, I began all the way back 100 years ago, and Arizona actually came in as one of the most progressive states in the Union in 1912. We had a labor governor. His name was George Hunt. He, in 1916, he said 99% of the miners in management have to fight the 1% of the copper bearers. So think about it, Bob. This was 100 years ago. We had a 99% movement in Arizona. It was the Labor Party, in fact, that pushed Hunt to power. And even Mother Jones came down and campaigned for Governor Hunt, saying he was the most radical governor in the nation. The problem, though, is Hunt fit in with the anti-extremists, the Brown Scare. After he took power, he, like many other progressives, betrayed the immigrant miners that put him into office. These were Mexican-Americans and other immigrants. And it really began a century of fighting back between sort of an anti-immigrant spasm and extraction companies and the labor forces in the communities who are largely indigenous Mexican American, or their pioneers and allies and Anglo. And so we bring that up to today. You know, the past really is the prologue to today. And once again, Arizonans, when SB 1070 broke out and all the Tea Party madness broke out 2 years ago, Arizonans didn't just give up. They didn't surrender. An incredible resistance movement took place, both within the youth, within older people, within bipartisan alliances we hadn't seen forever. You know, and if you think about the infighting we have in the coal fields, Bob, if you think about the divide and conquer ways of the coal companies, it's always been 10 times worse in the West because they've always played the race cards, you know, and divided the Latino communities and divided other communities and immigrant communities. And for the first time, in the last 2 years, I saw these communities come together. And I'll give you an example. The architect of SB 1070 was a man named Russell Pierce.
Right.
He was really the de facto governor of Arizona. He was the state Senate president. He was this radical Tea Party president. That's what he called himself. He didn't believe in the United States of America. He said, I am a citizen of the sovereign state. He was one of these kind of fringy 10th Amendment characters, you know, who believes in states' rights. And he's the one who is the pulling all the strings behind all this operation. Jan Brewer, a governor, is just a puppet, a character.
And Pierce also had direct ties with white supremacists as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, connected to neo-Nazis. His son was part of the Minutemen militia. You know, and he got caught in 2006 of circulating an email from a West Virginia group. I forget what they were called. They were Holocaust deniers. You know, and so the complete fringe, we laughed at people like Russell Pierce. Well, lo and behold, he's the one who took power, and he's the one who pushed through SB 1070. He had his 15 minutes of fame. And in 2011, the people there in Maricopa County said, hey, enough of this. We're going to go after him and do a recall election. Nobody thought they had a chance. It was only a tiny group, and the Democratic Party mocked them. The old-timers mocked them. Nobody believed they had a chance. It was a small group of young Latinos, some gray-haired, aging baby boomers, and a bit of the religious community. And door by door, they began to knock. They got enough petitions. They found a centrist candidate. And lo and behold, last year, they defeated Russell Pierce in a recall election. The first time in American history, a sitting state Senate president, someone who was invincible, was defeated. And I couldn't believe it. I was there chronicling, writing about it for Salon and Huffington Post, and it was just an amazing rebellion. And the national media didn't cover it at all. I mean, very minor coverage. And I thought it was really one of the biggest overlooked stories of the nation. And once again, it was part of this dismissal of Arizona as some sort of aberration, as opposed to really recognizing the people who were fighting back. And I think you can definitely see some similar parallels in Appalachia.
Oh, without a doubt. I was going to say, though, that as far as the national media are concerned, Jeff, had it been a case of a recall election to, say, remove someone like Kristen Sinema from her state office, it would have been splattered all over the national press as proof positive that the Tea Party had achieved an ascendancy and had become dominant and America had shifted further to the right. You know, all the typical tropes that they like to play. But they were successful in that recall election, Jeff. What has happened now with the miserable voting experiences, as I understand it from your writing that I ran into over at Alternate? What happened between then and now with what happened this past Tuesday?
This past Tuesday, of course, you know, it was the Latino vote that ultimately helped propel Obama back into the office. 75% of the Latinos voted for Democrats. And so we had Arizona, that record early Latino vote. They had incredible early collection of ballots. The 34,000 new Latinos had been registered. Incredible get-out-the-vote record. And so there we were, waiting. You know, we have some major races going on. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the famous, you know, toughest sheriff in America, was up for re-election. You know, he's 80 years old, and it's, you know, sort of larger-than-life cartoon character, for the first time in his life, had a very serious challenger. And on election night, we couldn't believe it. While the rest of the nation was celebrating, Arizona had this complete meltdown. you know, Romney won by huge margins, Arpaio won by huge margins. And in the U.S. Senate race, Richard Carmona, who's the former U.S. Surgeon General under Bush, was running as a Democrat. We really thought had an incredible chance to become the first Latino governor, Latino senator. He was beaten by a large margin. Then we go to bed and we realize hundreds of thousands of ballots hadn't even been counted. Anywhere from 1 out of 3 to 1 out of 4 of the ballots delivered hadn't even been counted. So the next day, immediately, Randy Pata, the man who led the Pierce recall, and all the young Latino organizers and many of the groups began to find out what happened. You know, we talk about Florida, we talk about Ohio with these provisional ballots, but Arizona blew everybody out of the water. We had over 635,000 provisional and early ballots that weren't even counted. You know, it's huge numbers, Bob. And so you had this little office, and most of those, by the way, were in Maricopa County, exactly where Sheriff Arpaio was. And so why, I began to investigate, why so many numbers? And basically what you had is a situation of where in especially heavy Latino voting areas, which we knew were going to go Democratic, suddenly all these obstacles and barriers were put in front of people. Why are you given a provisional ballot? It's because, let's say, Bob Kincaid has always lived in his house, and he re-registers or he registers, he goes to vote, he doesn't find his name on the list. They hand you a provisional just to make sure you're okay. And this happened to thousands upon thousands, hundreds of thousands of Latino voters who are ultimately disenfranchised and forced to go a different route. And I think that's what concerns us, is not ultimately the final count, but this incredible process of suppressing the vote and discouraging people from really coming out to the polls.
And I would not have known of any of this, Jeff, had I not seen what you've been posting. From where I sit, it looks like the suppression is obvious. But given the makeup of state government and election commissions and so forth, what kind of remedies are available? I mean, you've got Alan West in Florida throwing a hissy, and he's been bounced out of court twice on spurious claims. But you've got in excess of 600,000 suppressed votes in largely Maricopa County, and this isn't front page news.
Right. You know, finally the New York Times covered it, and then Rachel Maddow had a program last night, you know, nearly a week afterward. And so it's a waiting game. You know, right now, every night there's vigils. The recorder's office is jam-packed with observers. You know, you have a small group of staff who are obstinate, who are just taking their time to count them. They have until Friday. That's the final date to deliver the tally. So there is a clock ticking, thank God. But I think there's just real concerns about accuracy,
Are there concerns, Jeff, about the actual mechanism of voting? Optical scanners, video voting machines, that kind of thing. Was there any sort of that business that we've seen in the past?
As of yet, no. I think we're still just trying to get the darn things counted, you know. And so I think even that nuance, you know, of are they doing it correctly or is there any kind of ploy in the background, we don't know yet.
I'm 631,000 uncounted votes. That's a fifth of the election as it was cast. Mr. Carmona conceded. But is it possible that any of these elections could be, the outcome could be changed by counting them?
Oh, yeah. In fact, Carmona's spokesperson basically has said, hey, that concession can easily be retracted. Just because you concede doesn't mean you lose your election.
Right, or your right to contest when it turns out that there's evidence of fraud.
Al Gore is a good example. He conceded in the presidential campaign, if I recall, and then retracted it. And I think Carmona basically is in a waiting game. He is less than 4% away now. And so it'd be very close. There's a couple of congressional races, which are extremely close, one in a matter of hundreds. Arpaio seems to have a lead that can't be reached no matter what, but still we won't know until the final votes are counted. So really it's been an incredible waiting game, Bob. Let me tell you, everyone's been on pins and needles. There's a major demonstration planned for Thursday night. where all the groups once again are coming together to apply pressure to make sure that doesn't happen again. I think it's more to say, hey, you know, why do we have all these provisional ballots to begin with? Why is it that people who are American citizens, who registered correctly, are not listed on the registration ring? You know, I think there's got to be some sort of Department of Justice investigation. I think that's where people are pointing, is to really have some sort of federal investigation of what went wrong.
But even in the case of a DOJ investigation, Jeff, what scares me is that it seems that with all of this electoral trickery, that there seem to be very, you know, how do you, if for instance, you know, January's bearing down on us, and if Jeff Flake is seated as the junior senator from Arizona, can he be unseated if it turns out that he lost? I mean, what I'm getting at is the window of opportunity is very narrow, isn't it?
Well, no, I mean, we've had that before. We're more than, I mean, think about it. Al Franken and his, I forget, who was the person who ran against Al Franken? They both went to Washington, you remember?
Right.
And they both went through their first couple weeks of training or whatever they do in Congress. But, you know, that could be a point, too. And of course, Bob, as we know, if anything is truly close, it'll go either into litigation or recount or whatnot. And so, or some sort of court decision. So, I think it's going to be one of these things that's going to go on for a long time. And, I think the big issue though is we're in the midst of a historic demographic shift. And this is what I tried to put out in my book, State Out of the Union, is that Arizona, I call this the final showdown, and I wasn't just using hyperbole there. You know, we've been fighting this battle over who has the right to American citizenship for over 100 years. When Arizona came in as a state of the union, you know, I said they were very progressive, but there was as well this anti-immigrant spasm that Arizona should only be for Arizonans or Americans, as if somehow the people who had lived there for centuries were not part of the American experience. And I think that's something that we're finally getting over. You know, this last gasp of this right wing, this incredibly conservative, carpetbagger white wing, who really want to deny reality. They want to deny the fact that, hey, you know, it's not like Tucson crossed the border crossed Tucson. And these Mexican Americans have been here for centuries. It's just like indigenous people in Arizona have been here for centuries. And they make up part of our great historical legacy. And now it's finally coming to that historic shift. 80% of the gray heads in Arizona, like my folks, are Anglos, or what we call Anglos or white. And 60 to 65% of the youth are brown or Latino. And so you don't need to be a rocket scientist to do the math. I mean, within a couple of years, we're not going to have this discussion because there is going to be a Latino majority. And as Cesar Chavez said, one day the power will be reflected in the hands of the people who actually live there. I think that's what this is, this election, this whole Tea Party phenomenon, is a last gasp of the conservative right wing who don't want to come to grips with reality.
And I think what you've documented very well is in State Out of the Union, Jeff, is that there are people who are working toward a better, more progressive Arizona, and it is their efforts that will determine when that demographic shift comes. Their efforts will determine what nature, what quality that shift has, whether it will merely be a power shift from one group, from, you know, paler, powerful people to darker skinned, more powerful people, or whether it will be truly a popular shift. Based on my reading, is it safe to say that you are of the opinion that there is a lot to hope for along those lines?
Oh, definitely. You know me, I'm incredibly optimistic, but, you know, I see a continuum, a legacy there that I think underscores a lot of today's activism. You know, I came of age in the 1970s, Bob. I came of age in 1972. I was there in Arizona. My father was involved in migrant workers, and Cesar Chavez came back. And, of course, Cesar was from Arizona. His family owned land in Arizona before statehood, and they lost their land in a bad land deal, and they were forced into the migrant stream. But 1972, Arizona was in the headlines again. We had passed this horrible anti-migrant worker bill that said migrants could not boycott or have any strikes during the harvest. is basically shut up and pick the lettuce. And so Cesar Chavez came back and he organized, he started this Pizza Planning movement, you know, yes it can, yes you can, it can be done. And of course that eventually became President Obama's motto. And I think the impact of Cesar Chavez still reverberates today. He registered over 150,000 new voters. In 1974, Raul Castro became the first Latino governor of Arizona. And that's the Arizona I grew up in, you know, that there was this sense of political engagement, that we share the power and we share the legacy, both left, right, and center.
Well, Jeff, go ahead.
I was going to say, the activists we see today, I think, come out of that same cloth. You know, I don't want to pretend and say, yeah, it's the Latinos lean left or lean liberal, but I think what you do see is they come out of a social justice background. They come, you know, like many people in Appalachia had a granddaddy who was part of the union movement in the coal field. We have many people who are in Arizona who really come out of this continuum, this social justice legacy, either from the copper mines or from the fields or from the factories, that I think really inform a lot of their experience today.
Well, you and I have spent a lot of time, relatively speaking, talking about how we create a more holistic approach to bringing both rights and dignity to oppressed regions of this country. Of course, my primary focus has been Appalachia, naturally. But we've talked about understanding. We've talked about that day when various interest groups understand that their fight is the same fight as that of a different interest group. For instance, when the environmentalists understand that their fight is the same fight as women's rights, and women's rights understand that their fight is the same fight as immigrant rights, and so on like that. You've done a very good job of that over the years, and it was kind of inspiring when I read today on Huffington Post that you're still doing it, apparently I guess some would think a strange place, but there's a beautiful thing happening. You're on your way to Georgia. There's a beautiful thing happening on the campus at the University of Georgia right now, isn't there?
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. I'm on my way to Athens, and I'm sponsored by Freedom University. Freedom University, of course, sprang up 2 years ago when the state of Georgia banned any undocumented students from attending any of the state colleges. And of course, in most states, undocumented kids can go to college without any problem. In Georgia, it was outrageous. They banned the kids. You know, and think about it. You're banning people from getting an education and becoming the engineers and the intellectuals and the thinkers and the teachers and the doctors and the technicians and whatever of our future. So it was obscene. And so faculty rose up. They created what was called Freedom University, and that they were going to provide free courses. And so they're sponsoring me, and I'm thrilled to go down. But then it switched somehow in the organizing that the Beyond Coal anti-coal groups heard that I was coming, and they said, hey, we want to co-sponsor this. And so they got together, and so they said, hey, climate justice and coal justice can't be separated from civil rights and immigrant rights justice, that we have to come together as students. And so it snowballed. Suddenly you had 12, 13, 14 student groups co-sponsoring my visit, and they created this title, Injustice for All, Beyond Coal and Beyond Borders, you know, to really get these movements to see their common bonds and unite, and not to have sort of each of our own individual single issues that we're fighting for under the Obama administration. And to me, Bob, it's incredibly inspiring. I said, hey, I'll be there in a heartbeat. You know, I'm happy to go down, happy to do these kind of events, because I think this is where the youth is one step ahead of us, because they see that, you know, there is strength in numbers, that if we do sort of share each other's struggles, and we do recognize that just as the University of Georgia is dependent on Appalachian coal to run its boilers, it's also dependent on the labor of immigrants around the community, and both are being abused, and the abuse of the land is always hand-in-hand with the abuse of the people. They can see that there's a common solidarity, a common movement we have to recognize and come together. And so this issue in Georgia, to me, was really a breakthrough. I wrote about it today in Huffington Post, and I really, centered around to a lot of people, hoping that other campuses and other states, and ultimately the big Greens and the big organizations in Washington, pay attention to these kids and realize we have to embrace each other's causes.
I certainly hope the same, Jeff. And particularly, you know, you mentioned the big greens and the larger social justice organizations. I don't know how much they talk to each other. And if they can, you know, somewhere in the Bible it says, and a little child shall lead them. Well, we're not talking about little kids, but we are still talking about a segment of the population that is largely overlooked by the grown-ups who think, well, you know, wait till you grow up, kid. They've grown up. And I think by virtue of the fact that more young people came out and you know, proved all of the multimillionaire pundits dead wrong in this past election, the youth vote came out to vote in this election, I think, because they understand that their, or at least a significant part of them, that their fat is already in the fire, Jeff. And it's a coal fueled fire and an oil fueled fire and a frac gas fueled fire, and that the people who will be abused, as you say, when you abuse the land, you abuse the people. The people on the front lines of the abuse are also, in many cases, the same kids who are saying, we can't breathe this stuff, we can't bathe in this stuff. And so, I mean, are they, I guess you'll learn better when you get there, but are they really, really talking and seeing those commonalities?
I think they are. You know, last month, 12 kids got arrested at UGA in Athens during the Board of Trustees meeting. And it was undocumented kids coming together, anti-coal kids, around the issue of shutting down the boiler plants and converting it from coal. You know, one of the worst coal-fired plants in the nation is up there in Juliet, you know, the Shure coal-fired plant. It's a massive coal ash pile. It's considered one of the worst in terms of pollution and particulates. The communities all around it have astronomical rates of cancer and whatnot. And so I think there is that understanding of, you know, what we often talk about, the humanitarian crisis connected to these issues. I don't, you know, I think it's a learning curve too. And I think that's where we need people from the front lines, people who live both around coal burning, but also coal mining, to keep coming down and testifying and talking. Likewise, we need kids who are coming out of immigrant experiences to share theirs. I tell you a little anecdote that I thought was beautiful is, there was a group called, I think they called themselves the Center for the American Dream. And they went across America with a van load of kids who are basically talking about how they've been raised in the United States, but their parents had brought them here as young children and they were undocumented. But, you know, ultimately, they're American. And I think we all know that with the Dreamers. Well, their bus broke down in West Virginia. And, they were terrified. They had all sorts of, you know, illusions and stereotypes and misperceptions of what's going to happen to a bunch of poor Mexican kids who broke down in a bus. And I was contacted, immediately put them in touch with people who lived in that county, wonderfully taken care of, and it was a beautiful cultural exchange. I think also for them to get beyond a lot of the stereotypes and misperceptions of people of West Virginia. And so I feel like that kind of collaboration, both cultural, personal, and social, is really going to help our political gains in the long run as well.
I find this incredibly inspiring, Jeff, and I hope, I'm sure you'll be writing and reporting back on what you experienced. So you're on your way to Athens. Where after? I mean, one never knows where this show is going. So if folks have an opportunity to come and see you and hear you speak, I want them to have that opportunity. So tell us where you're headed.
Wednesday in Athens, and Thursday and Friday I'll be speaking in Macon, Georgia, a similar situation, at Wesleyan College, looking at issues of sustainability and at the same time civil and immigrant rights. That's really my banner now, Bob, is to say, you know, injustice for all. And we have to, if we don't look at all the issues together, we're doomed. I think the greatest issue, of course, is climate justice. And I think within that umbrella of climate justice, we have to look at environmental justice and our way of life. And I think that also includes how we deal with immigrants and civil rights. After that, on the weekend, I'll be down at Miami for the Miami Book Fair and dealing with immigration as well there. And it'll be interesting to see what the reception in Miami is, because obviously that's going to be an entirely different crowd than I'm used to in the Southwest or on the East or West Coast.
Very much so, because... The national media, of course, refer to the Latino vote or the Hispanic vote as if it is some sort of monolith, when it's very much not, and there are very much fragmented segments of it. So you really do perceive that you'll be among different mindsets?
Oh, yeah. You know, within Miami itself, you know, I think the Cubans and Caribbeans and Latin Americans who make up a lot of the Miami community have a very different perspective. Haitians as well, Dominicans. It's all come out of a different experience. Of course, where I grew up in the frontera of Arizona and Mexico, and, you know, I wrote a book on Mexico, too, in the past. I think you talked about that in your program. You know, there's definitely a different historical reality, a different historical legacy. Once again, a lot of my book looks at how rooted Arizona is in the Mexican and Mexican-American experience and the indigenous experience. Of course, that's very different with Cuba and Cuban-Americans in Miami. And so, yeah, I'll be very curious to see what the response is. I think for the most part, the response has often been just a lot of surprise. People, I think, assume I'm coming just to attack the Tea Party. And they don't realize that my book, like all my books, is about the other histories that have been left out, the progressive factions, the people who are the unsung heroes of American history who I feel like have been left out. And so typically it's a very surprised crowd because I try to show this continuum of resistance that has informed not only Arizona but the rest of the country, how Arizona and the Arizonification of America is ultimately going to be a beautiful thing. Taking this hate and turning it to human rights, taking this hate and turning it to love, and really trying to use Arizona's experience for the good for the rest of the country.
Well, I think I think it's noble work, and of course you always bring that, like you said, boundless optimism to your work. It's part of the process, Jeff, of the conversations we've had going on for years that. Well, I'm headed in the exact opposite direction. I'm going up to northern Wisconsin next month because I don't know if you remember the guy's name, but the mountaintop removal mining magnate Chris Klein.
Oh yeah, he's the one destroying the heartland, of course. He's
yeah,
buddy.
Right. Well, he's got that yacht docked somewhere. In some 1% harbor somewhere that's called Mine Games, M-I-N-E. Well,
sure.
I guess with as we watch the struggle that has taken place here in Appalachia, he's always looking for a new place to destroy, and he has since turned his sights on some of the most beautiful countryside that I've ever been exposed to, the land up by Lake Superior. And the Bad River region of northern Wisconsin and western Michigan and the native peoples there, and he's you know moving away from coal now, or expanding out from coal, and he's going after iron ore, and he wants to introduce mountaintop removal to northern Wisconsin.
All right.
So I'm heading out there to sort of point out that now is the time to start the fight. And they've got a fight on their own hands because their Republican, their legislature turned entirely Republican. And the first thing that they're setting, one of my contacts was telling me today, one of the first things they're setting their sights on is the overthrow of what is a pretty decent set of environmental laws in Wisconsin. So if we can, you know, if I can take my hillbilly hide out there and suggest to them that resistance is not only necessary, but ultimately a question of survival, then maybe we begin to do a little bit more of that link up that you talk about. And it gives one a little bit of hope. You know, you were instrumental in helping us get the word out about H.R. 5959, the AIC Act. You know, for the first time in American history, a bill has been introduced in the Congress, Jeff, that would finally end mountaintop removal. And I think that's a pretty daggum big deal. So
it's a huge deal, yeah.
There's a lot of reason for optimism to go around, but there's also plenty of hard work, and I'm awfully glad you're doing it, and mighty proud to have you on the program and call you my friend, Jeff. Thank you very much.
You bet, Bob. Well, good luck up there. I'll send you some contacts as well, and keep it going. Your program, your great voice in the wilderness, and we all appreciate what you do, and it's always wonderful to know your readership and listenership is is growing, and I see that everywhere. And, you know, you got to hang in there. The mountaintop removal is something that I feel has to be on the front burner for all of us now, even though we don't live in Appalachia. I still believe that if we can't stop mountaintop removal, all else is hopeless, because it's the one thing that can be stopped immediately, that should be stopped. And so we're there with you, and whatever way I can help, let me know. But that's one battle we're never going to give up on.
Well, I thank you very much, Jeff. And you know what? The neat thing is there are a bunch of us here who can – we really sense that we can end this. And if we – and if the movement for human rights and environmental justice needs anything, it needs one good, solid win. And I think we can provide that, and I look forward to celebrating it with you when we do. Jeff, drive carefully, travel safely, and all of our best regards to the good folks that you're going to be spending time with over the next several days.
Great. Take care, Bob. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Author, human rights activist, cultural historian, Jeff Biggers, most recently the author of State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. It's available through all of your primary booksellers. And as I said, Jeff's previous work, The United States of Appalachia, is sort of the textbook for the horn and understanding the Appalachian mindset from which we come. I would strongly suggest that you have on your shelf everything Jeff's written. Reckoning at Eagle Creek is a touching, beautiful, almost, it's like a prose poem to the land of Jeff's birth, Southern Illinois. In the Sierra Madre is gorgeous for what it said, what Jeff says about a people who are under the assault of modernism, the Rarámuri people. It's gorgeous. Jeff authored a brilliant biography of Don West. There's not a book of Jeff's that should not be on your bookshelf if you appreciate the cultural history of the often unmentioned, often undocumented, in more ways than one, struggles of the American people. State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, available both in book form and in electronic form, published by Nation Books. It came out this past September. And it is I'm just looking at the reviews over on Amazon, and the reviews it has received are uniformly of high praise. Just to offer up a little bit of background on what Jeff was talking about, what he's doing heading to Athens, Georgia. Freedom University student Joanna put up a video detailing what happened to her in Georgia when she was denied the basic right to attend an institution of higher learning. Here it is.
Hello, my name is Joanna. I'm 19 years old. I am proud to say I'm undocumented and unafraid. Currently, I'm a student at Freedom University in Georgia. This message goes out to students, faculty, and administrators at not only Harvard College, but to any college who is banning us from getting a higher education. Of course, not leaving out the dreamers. I hope this message will encourage the rest of the dreamers who are still living in the shadows to go out and say, I am undocumented and unafraid. I am one of many dreamers fighting for justice and education, but I can't say that I'm representing the whole dreamer community. Some of us are activists and some are not, just like some are smart with a high GPA and SAT scores, and some are not. Well, we are all the same because we are all dreamers, dreaming with a better future. My story started with my parents dreaming of giving me a better future. I was 2 years old when my parents brought me here. I didn't have a choice. But if I was to, I would do it the right way. I remember crossing the border with my mom, and I was hungry, and all there was around me were tomatoes, so I ate them just to keep calm. As I can remember, my mom and I at work from sunrise to sunset just to get food on the table. My mother's struggles made me want to be someone in life. I may have not had the choice back then, but I do have the choice now. And my choice is to give back to my community. I graduated with the class of 2011 at Cedar Shoals High School with a 3.2 GPA and with JROTC honors with the cadet rank of captain. I have tried to apply to many colleges, but they all turned me down due to my status. I was an Athens Tech, but being undocumented and not having the ability to go to work and pay for my education and not have the financial help was hard enough already. For a 3-credit class, I had to pay $1,075 for a 3-credit class. And I was like, how in the world am I going to reach a higher education with no financial help or any help whatsoever? Because I was undocumented, and I couldn't pay in-state tuition. I had to pay out-state tuition, and which was 3 times higher than in-state. So I had to drop out, but thanks to Freedom U, I'm getting a second chance in being that person who I want to be.
Barry College, I'm helping out.
And hopefully joining the Coast Guard. Freedom University is a voluntary program taught by 4 UGA professors. They provide free books, college-level classes to students not carrying their immigration status. Here in Georgia, we've been banned, like in many other states, from major colleges. For us, that is unfair, because we're not international students. We started school here in the United States and graduated from high school in the U.S. as well. We might have been born in different countries, but this is our country. The land, this land, has seen us grow into the adults we are now. I am a documented student, a dreamer. I'm done hiding and being casted out just because I am undocumented. So it's time for our voice to be heard. To all the dreamers who are hiding in the shadows, come out and say, I am undocumented and I'm unafraid and I'm fighting for justice and education. As I said, it's time for our voices to be heard because a higher education is a human right and we need to fight for it. No one is going to take that away from us. I want to thank the Senate Movement, CAD, and any organization